Officially recording. Right. So, this is another ad hoc Dargoth Hour, Dagoth Hour. Did we even agree to what it was called?
No, we didn't. And we didn't get any comments about that. Like you say, it's one of those things I've always said in my head and never really heard aloud. Maybe it's said in the game a couple of times. But yeah, in my head, it's always been Dagoth. But Dagoth makes sense as well. Dargoth kind of makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Someone on I think it was like YouTube Shorts was talking about how you can always spot an American doing a British accent because of the way they say daughter. Apparently they say data.
In American accent, it's daughter, isn't it? It's yeah. Like daughter.
You are daughter. My daughter.
The thing I noticed with Americans, when Americans are trying to do a posh British accent, like actors or whatever, because you know the grass versus grass.
Yeah.
So they learn, you know, do an elongated A, but then they do it at times when even posh people wouldn't do the elongated A. I can't think of any words right now, but...
Yeah, yeah. No, like, oh, mom.
They over-apply.
Mom is the
yeah,
big, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
because it's, everyone knows mama's in jam, not mama's in jam, right? That's the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the, yeah, they're big on their moms there, aren't they? We don't say moms or mams or anything like that. I
like the thing. It was. I found it odd the first time I saw it. But in the, I don't know if it applies over here too. But in the American military, like if you have a female commanding officer is sir, right?
Yeah.
Which I like. Degendered. I realize it's defaulting to the male gendered thing, but you know, degender.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can degender the other way as well. Like, I mean, you think nurse, right? Like, or.
Mm.
It's doctor, but like, is nurse a title or something? You know, like, it can go seamstress. Yeah, you don't have a seamster. That's ridiculous.
But that's a thing that was so we have actor and actress, right? Waiter. Mm-hmm. I mean, people tend to say server now, but waiter mm-hmm. and waitress. But we don't have like teacher and teacheress.
Hmm. Well, nowadays we're supposed to call actresses actors as well. That's kind of supposed to be.
Well, right. I always have. I don't see why we need. With all of those, I don't see why we need to gender the. Like I say, we don't have teacher and teacheress. But no. I was talking to Anjun about this. I think it comes in from like German roots or whatever. But because in German, it's like that for every profession. They do have teacher and teacheress. And you know, so on.
Yeah, and of course the French have, like, they have a very gendered language. It's one of the things I actually end up finding with a bit. It's not dissimilar to Welsh mutations, except Welsh mutations are orders of magnitude more complicated. But like, I always mix up my gendered items in French.
I don't know how you're supposed to. Gendered languages, yeah, as an English speaker, gendered languages are bewildering. It's just, why would you do that in the first place?
Mm. And there's weird things that it slipped in for us as well, like ships are gendered female, cars are often gendered female, rivers are gendered female, countries are gendered female. I don't know why.
I don't know if that's coming linguistically. Yeah, I think it's that. Yeah, I don't know whether that's necessarily come linguistically. Rather, yeah, just like when you've got, you know, a bunch of men at sea for months at a time, they would just like to imagine the ship as a lady. You know, like
it's a bit. I mean, we it's a bit poetic. Although, if you know, knowing sailors, it's probably something filthy. But it's like, yeah, I think when I was at university, you know, you read lots of old political texts and stuff. There was a lot of like there was much more gendered language about random stuff. Nowadays, if I was to write up in a newspaper, I don't think I'd use like her to refer to a river. I don't think I've ever referred to a river as her.
I don't think I've heard her with a river. Yeah,
I think that might be particularly old timey.
There's a lot of like poetic things, like, you know, the sea is a harsh mistress. Again, it's like, but that's because it's men making the language, I think, and they'd like to imagine it. You know.
Yeah. 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 So it's, I mean, exactly. And also, like, through how much of human history was it basically only men that could read, right? And even only a specific type of, like, you know, a specific class of man, right?
Yeah.
Like, clergy,
like either aristocracy or if you were poor, become a monk. That was your best way. Like, the educated people in Europe in the Middle Ages were really the monks, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I'd be all right as a monk in the Middle Ages.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think people would...
And they were known for, you know, they got an education and all that. But they were known for just being drunk all the time.
Yeah. Well, they make the wine. I would like to be. This is a weird like historical fantasy I've got. It's like I'd love to be like the medieval monk that brings weed to the UK. Like,
But there were less like now we think of monks like they're cloistered, right? They live in close communities. But back in medieval times, like they'd be out in the they'd get their education and then they would be the educated members of the church, really, because the priests were lay priests. In the Orthodox Church, all priests are monks, right? They don't have a lay clergy, but over here, priests are they're elevated from the peasantry, right? So they don't have that education. They just they read the service and that's all they do. They don't really have the theological education that that was what the monks were for, and they sort of travel around and sort out theological issues and stuff, but also just sort of help people in general. I mean, I'm not saying I'm not trying to paint it as entirely rosy. They also quite.
Well, they were a political force in a lot of communities.
Well,
Yeah, I mean, actually, interestingly enough, and I'm not super like knowledgeable about the medieval history of religion in the UK, but or even it, actually, this is kind of a side issue. But the game Kingdom Come Deliverance, which is set in what do you call it? It's Bohemia from, oh my God, like King Wenceslas, and oh.
well, it's like 1300, 1400, somewhere around there.
I want to say later than that, but I'm not entirely sure. Anyway, a lot of the storylines in there involve the local monastery's relationship to the village, and it sort of demonstrates them as a political force, not dissimilar to like a political party now, or sort of maybe like a university town or something like that, or they're the
Yeah, I
medieval
think
equivalent.
University Town is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
1403.
1403,
Kingdom Come
yes.
Deliverance. So my village, the village that I live in, has always been kind of an adjunct to something more important. So originally the village sprung up around a Roman fort in, around about zero. And then the Romans left in, what was it, 50 AD? And then in the Middle Ages, there was a big abbey. So yeah, literally, like in Kingdom Come Deliverance, like a big abbey with the little village around it supporting it, and apparently that abbey was like one of the most corrupt ones. There was, they were awful. Then the abbey went, and then it was the mills. We had a wool mill, and then a cotton mill when colonialism fully kicked in, and then the mill, the village was there just to serve that. And now it's the JCB factory, which is like literally when you look on the aerial photos, the JCB factory is like the same size as the village.
Wow, that's amazing.
So we've always just been this sort of like adjunct to some other bigger endeavor,
Well, I suppose in some ways you're kind of positioned for it, right? Geographically.
Yeah, I mean, well, for the mills, we're right by two rivers, so and again, for the fort as well, being on the meeting point of two rivers for a fort is perfect. You've got to cross two rivers to get,
There's a lot of Roman forts by two, where rivers join. There's one up here where the two rivers join as well. Blestium, I think, is
I
its
think
name.
the so it's so we're Roaster. My village is Roaster. If anybody wants to stalk me. Which is, Rochester, and apparently that like the Ro part is Celtic for the bit of land between two rivers, and then Kestra is obviously, fort. So yeah, the fort on the bit between two rivers is what we're called.
Do you know there's a great Tom Scott video that talks about the hill that has like embedded the word for hill from every time it was like colonized. So there's like a hill that's called Hill 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 Hill, but it's like one hill is
Yeah,
like
in like five
Saxon.
different languages.
It's like that's kind of
And that's it always tends to be like when you find people's endonyms, like some tribe or whatever or ancient civilization, and you try and work out what their name for themselves means, and it always just ends up meaning the people.
Yeah, but it's just, it's brand, it's power of branding, isn't it, really?
And it also so Byzantium, the city of Constantinople, blah blah blah, it was conquered by the Ottomans in 1453, and apparently and then got renamed Istanbul, but apparently Istanbul just means into the city, which is lovely. It's like, where are you going? Oh, into the city.
Interesting.
Okay, that's like That becomes an element,
Yeah, but I mean, you got how many districts called downtown are there in America? You know, how many we got, like, three different Newports. We got a new town. And those are just like the ones that aren't named after saints, right?
We've got some round here. We've got, I think we are, because like in the Midlands has never been since Mercia was a big deal. The Midlands has never been an important part of England, right? It's the overlooked part. And I think because of that, like it's been, it's got remnants of the Celtic stuff, it's got remnants of the Saxon stuff, it's got remnants of the Norman stuff. So our place names, some of them are Celtic, some of them are distinctly, Saxon or, Old English. And then some are literally French. Like we've got some place names around here that are literally just in French.
That's great.
I can't remember any of them off the top of my head, but I know that.
Is this, we're supposed to do a politics podcast, aren't we? I suppose that is
What I do want to
politics, isn't
say
it?
about the last, so my internet is very fucked at the moment. And on the last podcast, there was a delay between me and you. There's a note because I listened back to it. There was a noticeable delay. Like you'd say something, and I like it'd be a second, and then I'd react or laugh or whatever. And that is just my internet. If that's annoying for anybody, I'm sorry. My internet's shit at the moment.
No worries. I mean, I'm talking you through a VPN. Does that add that latency? Probably, right?
No, that shouldn't.
No.
That should be negligible. It's my internet is very screwed.
Fair enough, fair enough. I don't know if I'm just used to it, because I mean there my sometimes my internet's rubbish and I'm used to like social latency.
Maybe we don't notice it. Yeah, with it being Discord calls, there's always a little bit of,
I think
Anyway, politics. Oh, there's something. We got a little bit reprimanded for not getting. We kind of we got into the details and then we did the summary at the end, right? So some stuff I want to summarize at the start. Okay, first of all, let's get the French election out of the way. I don't understand the French election. I don't think the French understand the French election. But as far as I can tell, they do. They have like a kind of constituency-based thing like us, but they do preferential voting, like rounds of preferential voting.
Yeah, well, they got a runoff for the
As
presidency.
in, yeah. So you go to vote. You vote for your party. If no party gets above 50%. Then there's a second round. Then anybody who gets under 12.5, I think, gets dropped out. And there's a second round of voting. And then you vote again. And like so until somebody gets over 50% of the vote, basically. Which I'm not sure how I feel about preferential voting. Like, I like the idea that, you do at least end up voting for either the winner or the loser, right? Rather than just. But in my situation, so say, okay, I vote green. And Green gets 5% of the vote, and they dropped out of the first round. And then the next round would probably be Labour, Tories, and Reform. And in that round, just because Reform is present, I'd probably vote Labour. And then it'd be a round of Labour versus Tory, and I probably just wouldn't vote. I don't care, So I'd rather have proper PR than preferential voting, I think.
I mean, all I know at this point is that first past the post is the devil. Like, it's the worst.
Yeah,
You know, I,
it really
you
is.
know, we talked about this last night, and we said some spicy things that I don't think we probably want to necessarily put on episode two of the podcast. But it's like with the first past the post, you get an inevitable two-party system, and with the two-party system, you kind of have a way of laundering responsibility, right? So it's either it's not their fault, it's not my fault, it's their fault, vice versa, and they take it in turns to blame each other, which is a great way of just sort of avoiding doing anything, and it puts you into a bit of a stalemate, and it's just like the reason we're here is
And
fundamentally.
you're beholden to the electoral cycle. So in a capitalist system, both parties need the donors to compete in the election. So you just end up with two parties that are beholden to capital, rather than, one party that represents capital and one party that represents the workers, which is what, we're kind of supposed to have. Yeah, it just doesn't function. And then the short termism, it's a 5-year cycle, so you can't plan anything beyond 5 years, and you just get these. You generally get like a couple of terms of one party, then a couple of terms of the other party. Usually a bit more leaning towards the Tories, right? So you gem, you know, so, so the Tories will come in, do a bunch of, minor technocratic fiddling, and then Labour will get in and undo all that, and then the Tories will come in and undo all that, and like it's just so fucking pointless.
Yeah. And it so you know, like I thought, like one of the things that kind of got me, because we did have a referendum on preferential voting, and David Cameron managed to convince basically most people that they were too stupid to put things in a preferential order. So
Yeah, I mean, that's the story.
yeah, I'm just kind of like, I mean, I know
The thing is that whole one of the conditions for that you're talking about when the Lib Dems went into coalition with the
that's what,
Tories, right? And sacrificed their entire policy platform, apart from they asked for a referendum on PR, and the Tories were like, "Yeah, sure, we'll give you a referendum on PR," and they gave us a referendum on the shittest possible version of PR, right? The absolute, the only one that's worse than
No,
what we've got
AV.
already.
AV.
But I mean, it was a PR vote that Lib Dems wanted. That was just what they were, given. The Lib Dems. That was I don't want to get into this too much, but
No.
that was the stupidest fucking political move in the history of the UK, I think, what the Lib Dems did.
Yeah, I think it's
There was no good outcome for them.
no. I think they managed to get score some environmental wins that they ended up losing when the Conservatives got their majority, though. So I mean, they were kind of like the airbag to a car crash government, right? Like it's there were some things
I
they've.
don't buy. Clegg likes to present it as, I realize it hurt the party, it hurt me politically, but I was doing the right thing for the country. Like, he likes to present himself as a martyr, which is absolute bull. That was not the right. You could have had a left-wing coalition. You didn't have to go into coalition with the Tories. The Tories were the biggest party, so okay, there's a bit of a democratic thing, but there were enough. With the Lib Dems, SNP, Labour, and the little bits and bobs all put together, I think there was enough to form a government.
Possibly,
But they chose the Tories.
I wonder what went on in that meeting where they had that big meeting where they hashed it out. Like I want to know what was said. I was.
Well, I mean, I know what happened. Like, the Tories, who are, politically sophisticated and understand the game, versus the Lib Dems, who are naive and don't understand the game and think everybody's acting in good faith.
Yeah, but
And they got fucked. They got absolutely fucked.
they've all got flower shops to run and geography classes to teach. You can't expect them to be like. Sorry, the Lib Dems are just so easy to make fun of. Like I kind of have a bit of a soft spot for them. Lucy always goes on about how I never shut up about the Lib Dems, so she's probably a bit right, to be honest. But it's like they're kind of an amusement, really, aren't they? I mean, I think Ed, I've even quite enjoyed watching Ed Davey go to Thorpe Park and have a various just like lovely time. I saw him playing Jenga not too long ago. You know,
Yeah,
so
I kind of like that.
it
I just because okay, so a
was
full kind of full disclosure thing. So in that election, I can't remember what year was it, 2015, was it?
2010.
I couldn't bring myself to vote for Ed Miliband. So I think I actually voted Lib Dem in that election. I was just like, fuck it, I'll just vote for
A
the
lot
Lib
of people
Dems.
did,
Like, they're all right. Yeah, and then they went into coalition with the Tories, which is the opposite of what I would have ever wanted. I felt utterly betrayed, and they scrapped the tuition fees. They scrapped the whole policy platform, basically. And I just have a visceral hatred of them since then. I couldn't possibly vote for them.
A lot of people feel the exact same way. I like, yeah, I mean, I think in hindsight, I think Ed Miliband would have been, well, was not as bad as I think he could have ended up being. Certainly not as
Wasn't
bad.
as bad. I was kind of disillusioned with politics at the time, and I wasn't paying a ton of attention to the election. I think Ed Miliband was actually better than I thought he was.
Well, I don't know. This might be a little bit of like hindsight being 2020 because he, since the Conservative government, he's generally held, obviously something vaguely front benchy in the shadow cabinet, for a spell, if not currently, something to do with the environment. And he went up against, I think Boris Johnson pretty aggressively, on environmental policy. And I've seen Ed Miliband do interviews about. The importance of climate policy and stuff like that, and I think, yeah, you know what, like that's actually a lot better than, well, I mean, it's a lot better than Keir Starmer, if I'm completely honest, right?
Well, my understanding of Ed Miliband's campaign is that his instincts are a bit more left, but he was pulled right by advisors, right? You can't you, like you've got to get the centre, basically, that kind of argument. Like he's not quite a Corbyn level of left, but he's certainly to the left of
he might be palatable for a good number of people, and that's not nothing, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think if he'd been allowed to run his, I mean, it was a weird time. He personality might add a lot in that election, and he wasn't the most exciting sort of media figure. But yeah, I think if he'd been let to run his own campaign, I think he probably would have won.
He kind of fouled to something similar that Gordon Brown had, where his advisors were supplying him with a strategy not suitable for the personality. And Corbyn, that's the thing. Yeah. It's like, it might work for Blair, but it ain't going to work for someone who isn't Blair, right? Like, every strategy needs to be basically tailored around the personality of your leading guy.
I wish Corbyn, like, first, of the two general elections that Corbyn fought in, first time round, I quite like Corbyn. I think, but second time round, he seemed very controlled, very constrained, made a lot like more like mediatized.
Too cautious.
And I preferred him when he was a bit more. I preferred him when he was a bit more off the cuff and a bit more honest.
Yeah,
like you know when he was asked, like it wasn't presented as a good answer, but when he was asked about Brexit and he said, or about the EU and he said, like I'm two fifths out and three fifths in or something. It was something like that, right? I can't remember the exact words.
Yeah.
And you know he got kind of ridiculed for that, but I like that. That's a good answer to the EU question.
It's like basically the right answer as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
The EU has a shit ton of problems, but at the same time, working together with other countries is essential for prosperity, right?
Security and there's a lot about the EU that I dislike, but I like, you know, I mean, I'm a socialist. I like internationalism.
There's more socialists in the European Parliament than there probably is in our Parliament.
Yeah, but the European Parliament, I don't know, it's not getting to the... We need to do an EU episode. The EU Parliament has no fucking power, that's the problem.
No, yeah, yeah.
The Commission has all the power, and they're not elected.
No, that pushed a lot of the... Not a lot of people, but that pushed like a non-zero number of people to the Brexit side.
I've got to say, I hate Brexit as an issue. I hate hardcore leavers and I hate hardcore remainers. And I think I hate hardcore remainers a little bit more than I hate hardcore leavers. They are more blinkered. They are less willing to understand the other side's position.
That is always very annoying when there's a breakdown of empathy, particularly by the people that love to shriek at empathy at the top of their lungs when it fits their narrative.
I mean, the Remainer position, really, they're like, you're all racists. That's why you don't want Brexit. The EU is great for me. Why don't you want it?
Yeah, that's the thing.
And they never ask, is it great for them? They never ask, is it great for them? Or is it, you know, is it appreciably? Like if you live in, if you're middle class, you know, well educated, you know, of a sort of, you know, metropolitan kind of, I don't want to say quite elite, but you know, you're a comfortable metropolitan person. Like you see what the EU does for you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you know, if you're in a small town, if you're rural, if you're poor, like you don't really, like even if the EU does technically do things, you don't see it. You don't see the benefits of it.
The EU was awful at promoting the projects that it was funding. Wales got a lot of money out of the EU, but you'd never know. Yeah. You'd never know. And I think that was a stupid thing to do. Like if you're giving like the one thing that Trump really fucking nailed, right, was when he was given the stimulus checks through COVID, he was like, I want the word fucking Trump on him. I want Trump's going on it. And it's like, you know, like that's how the left need to think. Right. Like, I don't know if we said this last episode, but like 90% of politics is vibes. Right. Like. And people can smell inauthenticity in a lot of cases, particularly on the left where people are sniffing for it. And
for sure, yeah.
Yeah. And because the thing
one thing I'd really like, just a presentational thing. Mm. I wish the political left would start referring to profit, tax and rent all as tax. Because for a normal person, they're all forms of taxation. They're all ways money is taken off you.
Yeah.
The difference is that profit just goes into a rich person's bank account. Tax is used to do useful things, and rent goes into a rich person's bank account. It's all money that's taken off you. So when the Tories are like, oh, to Labour, you know, it's the usual charge. You're going to raise taxes. Well, they can just go, well, so are you in the form of profits and rent. Would you rather pay taxes to the government who are going to build libraries, schools, hospitals, blah blah blah, or would you rather pay rents and profits to corporations and, you know?
Yeah, that I mean that would be a solid tactic if it could stick the landing, or even something you could even go something a bit softer and more straightforward and just say household outgoings. household outgoings will increase under Tories and not under Labour. I think Bernie Sanders sold that point rather quite well with his.
I think he did. Yeah, he sort of went in that direction, didn't he? A little bit.
But part of it was that he just wouldn't shut up about it. But that's fine. Like, it's great. I think some of the most successful politicians and agitators are the ones where they get their specialist subject and they just don't shut up about that. And I think, unfortunately for Corbyn, a lot of that was foreign policy, which he had some very, is anything straightforward when it comes to foreign policy, you know, and like nuance?
I think the problem, honestly, I think if he was given time to sort of present his case and lay it out, I think the public will probably generally agree with him on foreign policy. I think people generally don't want to do wars. They don't want to, you know, so on.
Yeah, but foreign policy, there's always nuance.
No, what I was going to say, just briefly, I don't think people vote on foreign policy. I think that's the problem.
With it's a tiny number of exceptions, but yeah.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, but generally speaking, people don't vote on foreign policy. No. Largely because they don't really understand, you know, I don't mean because they're stupid, but it's, we're not really given the full picture on foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to get a full picture. It's ununderstandable, and how far does the history go back, and... You know, because
the sort of layers you need to go through to explain like what's happening and why it's happening.
Yeah, and to be honest, the simplest approach which I tend to take on is like how can we stop people dying and getting killed, and how can we then house them and feed them and educate them, right? Like that's
which there was the spirit of after World War II, right? Again, we were talking about the UN last night. I don't like the structure of the UN, but the idea that you know. The job of pan-national organizations now is to like make war the last resort. Mm. You know, that's basically it in a nutshell, right? Let's just make war a last resort.
Yeah. And it can be done. So
yeah.
But you know, money, corruption is quite a few there's quite a few people that actually just really want to push war, really. Do you know what? An interesting film that I saw that really did kind of shape my views on my sort of like my essence values on foreign policy was Lord of War with Nicolas Cage.
Really? I've never seen that. I know the gist. But...
Yeah. It's vaguely based on a true story, but like, you know, in that Hollywood way, which it probably really isn't, maybe some of the names are the same or something like that. but it's kind of good. It's been a while.
It's an arms dealer selling arms to both sides, basically. Right?
Basically. That's right. Yeah. And it's pretty solid about that message. When did it come out? It came out like ages ago. It's like maybe early 2000s. So it's a little bit after. It was like so you had a bunch of like grungy films like The Matrix and Fight Club and Sin City, and then there was like a little bit of respite of things that were a little bit more cerebral, but not like proper like in the mainstream, but not proper cerebral, just like a bit more like softened, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit more sensibility politics, kind of almost. Anyway, we're on so French election, right? So
the right wing are doing great, basically. Yeah, the right wing look like that. You know, the far right look like they're going to win. It's basically the far right versus a sort of a leftist, you know, social democrat and socialist alliance, and it's looking like, you know, 30-odd% to 20-odd%.
30-odd% to 20-odd%.
Yeah,
that's 50%.
No, sorry. The right wing are going to get 30-odd%, and the left alliance are going to get 20-odd%.
Has that not already happened? Is the runoff not actually? I thought that was.
That's what I'm saying. That's the first round. Then it goes to runoffs.
Yeah, so we're down to the big left versus the hard right, and who do you reckon? I don't know. Like, it's the thing about French politics, as I understand it, from what I've been told, is that it's something that the French talk about very much amongst themselves. But to actually get like a solid perspective from the outside is actually very difficult.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, Macron he lost a lot of ground with things like fuel prices, right? The French hate it when fuel prices go up.
I think France is in similar situations, but like we've got, you know, just centrism just isn't working, so people and there isn't really a credible left, so they're turning to the right.
Although this left seems to have come out of nowhere, and
it's a coalition, and it
covers the usuals, including the Greens, I think.
Yeah,
So I don't know. Where do you think that centre ground vote will go? Is this almost like, is fascism just liberalism in crisis? Right? Are we going to find out?
Well, I mean, I very firmly think it is. Yeah, I think every turn, when liberals are presented with the option of, well, we either need to go socialist or the far right take over, that they're much happier with the far right because that doesn't challenge the fundamental structure of their power or wealth or whatever.
Yeah, so
I feel like we can ride out the far right, but socialism completely upsets the apple cart.
So you reckon Le Pen's got this then?
I don't know. In those terms, in terms of the electorate, I don't know. I don't understand French politics. I don't understand the electoral system enough. I suspect it will probably be a very small right-wing majority.
Yeah.
I don't think those kind of, like, the Farages and the Le Pens and that, I don't think they'll actually be very good in government.
Oh, no. See, so I was kind of told that this could, in theory, actually work out really well for Macron because he dips out for a couple of years. Le Pen gets in. Basically the idea is give them enough rope to hang themselves, and then they swoop in as the neoliberal saviors.
I mean, that was kind of his idea, right? Give them enough rope to hang themselves. I'm not sure whether it's a good idea, but
that's what David Cameron sort of was hoping with, and that didn't really work out so well for him.
Yeah.
Why do people take political gambles? It doesn't.
It's one of those situations where if you win, the payoff is quite small. If you lose, like the payoff for the other side is huge, like, or the loss is huge.
I was gonna make a Brexit point, but you know what, I'm not. The trouble is is that, like, if Le Pen gets in, is there going to be a Frexit?
That's interesting. I don't know if there's an appetite for it. I know there's some. I know that in all the major European countries, there's some appetite for it now. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't really. I mean, yeah. I brought up the French election, but yeah. I don't really know that much about French politics, French internal politics.
Because for a while the appetite for splitting up the European Union was kind of like has kind of subsided. It faded down a little bit when they saw what a hash we made of Brexit. Now, we made a particular hash of Brexit, right? Like, we didn't have to do it that badly. Like, it was kind of like a Dutch exit, right? Where, like, in theory, right, you could have done Brexit over the course of 30 years of just slow, methodical deconstruction and work.
The problem is that wouldn't have sat well with the people who voted out, right? It was like, I don't think that was tenable.
I mean, nothing is tenable. Like, that's the thing. Like, what we had was not tenable.
I mean, politically tenable. Like, in terms of, like, doing what's best for the economy, I think that's out the window. Once you've had the referendum and the majority, it's slim majority as it was, but the majority has voted Brexit, I think if we're a democratic country, you've got to enact that. I think good faith dictates you've got to do that as quickly as possible.
I don't think so, especially on the basis of 48-52, to me, if you were going to act on that, right, because, advisory, not advisory, whatever, like, I wouldn't have thought it would be unreasonable to have a confirming election. I think that...
Not in the political climate at the time. That would have been seen as such a betrayal. That would have been seen as, like, we're going to keep having referendums till we get the right answer.
Well, no, you can then, instead of it being an advisory one, you make it a committed one.
Yeah, but they said it was an advisory, but they said they would abide by it. So, it was advisory in name, but...
If they were going to...
I don't think they could have got away with that. The mistake was having the referendum. As soon as you have that referendum, you have to do what that referendum
says.
Yeah,
okay. So if we go along that path, we had a 52-48. So why does that result in the hardest possible Brexit? To me, a slim majority means the softest possible Brexit, because that way you keep the most number
of
people.
But that's not how it works, right? It's not like, if the Tories win an election with a slim majority, you don't go, well, you've got to be a leftist Tory government.
I mean, it works. It seems to flip the other way around, doesn't it? Keir Starmer is a...
Oh, yeah. That's a presumably straight to the right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's going to get a huge majority, and it's not going to be a left-wing,
No. But at that point, you know, in like the I don't know, we mentioned this before we went on, didn't we? That like there is going to be a lot of, well, first of all, most of Labour MPs are going to be brand new, shiny, fresh out the wrapping, and there's a good chance that a lot of them could be substantially left wing. Are we moving into the British politics now?
Do you know what? I'm actually a bit panicky. Would it be possible to do it, like, end it there and
Wrap it
do a
up?
hard cut and pick it up?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, that's good because it cuts us off at the French election. Très bien. Good luck, France. I hope you have a country this time in a couple of weeks. Fair play to France. They knock out their elections a lot faster than us and a hell of a lot faster than the Americans. So, well done. You don't hang about. Cool. All right. So, thank you very much for watching. And of course, always leave your comments. And we love to hear how you're doing. And also, feel free to point out all our mistakes because we certainly, with the French election, probably made a whole bunch of mistakes. So, yeah, check the comments for any corrections. Toodaloo.